Hey everyone, this video is out a week later than it was supposed to be published. We're still battling our schedule. The voting in the World Zionist Congress election has wrapped up in the United States. However, it's still going on in Britain at least, and the conversation me and Ben had touches upon some more general issues regarding Zionism and Jewish diasporic self-determination, so we're still very happy to present it to you. Enjoy! Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of The Jewish Diasporist. We've had a little bit of a delay when it came to releasing episodes not too long ago, but we are finally getting back into a strong rhythm. There's a lot of stuff to talk about, and today it's actually just me and Ben. It's a shame that we couldn't get Jordan on as well, especially for this conversation, because we know that he would have had some interesting things to say and a nice perspective to bring. But today we would like to talk, just the two of us, about the ongoing election to the World Zionist Congress. For those of you who might be bored or confused by this, you know, why are we talking about them? You know, it's important in many ways to understanding what Jewish political engagement with Israel outside the world is. I mean, sometimes this has been even referred to as a Jewish parliament. And even if we're just looking materially wise, a lot of the decisions that are being done are to do with funding for various different organizing efforts and institutions, both in Israel and abroad. The number that we've seen most has actually been like $5 billion. So this isn't your regular student union election. There's actually, these things actually do matter, whether we like it or not. We will not be voting in the election, as you might imagine. And we can sort of start off right away, because one of the main points to sort of discuss is when we discuss Zionism in this context, we are not just talking about some sort of abstract set of ideals or even like a buzzword that sometimes people use to just describe whatever they like or whatever they don't like in pertaining to like Israel or Jews. But it's actually a movement that has a central organization that isn't the Israeli state in many ways. It's actually the World Zionist Organization, and it has its own program. So that's where we're going to start off, and then we're going to go more and more into details regarding the election itself. We've got different contexts that we're coming towards this, and maybe a little bit also regarding some alternatives in terms of what a Jewish parliament could actually look like in a local, national, or global context. So Ben, why don't you start us off with discussing, like, what is Zionism?
Yeah, I think it's such a good question, because it's something that on the surface seems really simple, but in actuality is like one of the more complicated questions. I mean, we often say two Jews, three opinions. And I think on this question in particular, that could not be more true. I mean, in this upcoming and ongoing election in the United States, there's like 22 different slates that all have ever so slightly different visions. And as we're going to talk about going forward, like arguably one, maybe two of those slates could even be considered remotely on the left. I think it's really important to recognize that this really isn't a Jewish parliament, it's a Zionist Congress. We're going to talk about it, but one of the requirements to actually be able to vote is to accept the Jerusalem program, which is the Zionist movement's platform. And that has a very clear definition. And I think it's helpful for us to think about what is Zionism to actually look at that platform, because this isn't just an election for Jews, even though in order to vote, you have to be Jews. It's an election for Zionist Jews. And that's actually why Zach said we're not going to vote, because theoretically, I mean, no one's going to audit it. No one's going to necessarily say, oh, we're going to not count your vote because you've violated the Jerusalem program or you don't actually accept it. But maybe they would if things like were upset as much as they could be by a mass of non/anti-Zionist Jews voting in this. But who knows?
So let's actually get into this right now, because a lot of people have opinions about Zionism, right? For better or for worse. But when you actually ask them, what do you think of the Jerusalem program? I assume that for a lot of people listening and just in general conversations, for people that are involved in like the Jewish community, Jewish intercommunal politics, or like general Israel-Palestine stuff, you won't really necessarily know what the Jerusalem program is. So why don't we just start off and take a look at that?
Yeah.
Do you have it in front of you?
I do. So this was adopted in February 2024. It says, as the successor statement to the Basel program of the 1897 Zionist Congress, which we could talk about, and I think it's actually valuable to recognize that as diasporists, as Bundists, the Bund has always been counter to the Zionist election. I mean, the first Bund, like when the Bund was founded, it was on that same year of 1897. And the Jerusalem Program states that Zionism, the national liberation movement of the Jewish people, brought about the establishment of the State of Israel, I'm quoting here, and views a Jewish, Zionist, democratic, and secure State of Israel to be the expression of the common responsibility of the Jewish people for its continuity and future. Already hearing that, you could see why we might not be in agreement with what this program is and how, frankly, like this is the official stance of what Zionism is. Like, so many times people say, Zionism this, Zionism's that. It's like, sure, the Zionism that exists in your head might be that, but we're not just talking about ideals. We're not just talking about ideas. We're talking about actual practical applications of these ideas. And as we read these points, I think you're going to notice just how problematic this really is. So the first point of the Jerusalem program is the unity of the Jewish people. Not so bad, but it continues. Its bond to its historic homeland, Eretz Yisrael, and the centrality of the state of Israel and Jerusalem, its capital, in the life of the nation. You have anything to say about that, Zach?
I mean, I think that this point of centrality of Israel, it makes it so that to identify as a Zionist is not just to believe. And this is something that, you'll speak to, for example, some old Jewish socialists from who have experience in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and they will say things like, "I think given the current conditions, Israel should exist," or like, "Israel existing is a matter of fact. And there's nothing that really can be done about that, and just like two-state solution, pro-peace, etc., etc." But that's not a very like suitable line to really say that because a person believes that like Israel will exist into the future, whether we like it or not, whether its establishment was good or not, that doesn't necessarily make them a Zionist, right? Even just believing that like, oh, I guess Israel is a place that Jews can go to in case things go badly elsewhere. That's a like sentiment that a lot of people have for the necessity of why Israel should exist, just as like an escape place.
Yeah, it's the Jewish safety argument.
Yeah, but that's not what we're talking about here. The point of the program and the idea is not that Israel is a backup option. The point is that Israel is the main place where you are Jewish. Or that you have to see it as the central part of your Jewish identity, which even a lot of people who might sort of identify as Zionists or say, like, oh, Israel's important to me, they won't say that Israel is the central part of their Jewish identity. This depends often like how the question is phrased and how it is, practically. You'll have one situation that I remember is I once knew someone who was a national director for a Zionist youth organization in Britain, and I sort of asked him like, "Oh, what do you do as like what you work?" They weren't particularly like right wing that bad, but so we had a conversation just about it, and he said like, "Oh, one of the main points is like encouraging Aliyah," and then I asked him, "So are you planning on making Aliyah?" And he just said, "Oh no, of course not," right?
That reminds me of a bit where I read about a Zionist organizer historically way back in the day, basically making the same thing about like him and his family. And someone was like, oh, so are you going to make Aliyah? And he was like, well, no. And then the author made the point that Zionism in diaspora is the right of other Jews to make Aliyah. Because often people are pretty dang comfortable in their homelands, places they actually know and have community and feel safe with each other. And I think when we read that first point, the line, the centrality of the state of Israel, like this isn't even, it says like the historic homeland, Eretz Yisrael. Like, think as diasporists, we would challenge that. Like, maybe it's one of many homelands that Jews might feel a connection to. But the centrality of the state itself, I think, is hugely problematic because it's saying that not only is like this land important, which was actually the line of the original Zionist Congress and the movement, where it wasn't actually about a state until the 1940s, the Biltmore Program. But the state itself being so central, I think just shows how much that Zionism has morphed into something that is statism. It's the idea of laying claim to a territory and having a demographic majority in that place, and that is core to what it means to be Jewish in their understanding of it.
And also something that's important, there's often this like point of discussion. It's kind of like a Motton Bailey in saying that, oh, do you feel a connection to Israel, right? And I think that that's a like a bar that's quite sufficiently low that even a lot of people that are not particularly like that, like they'll be consider themselves diasporists or even like non slash anti-Zionists, they will say, oh, like I have a connection to Israel, but you can have a connection to the like the religious traditions, the land, the people who live there, the language, the culture, like the communities, you know, you might have family that lives there, but that's not necessarily Zionism. That's like you have a connection to a place that has a, of course, like a Jewish history and tradition, and millions of Jews live there today, but that doesn't mean that you like you place your entire identity beyond the pale of the state and the bureaucracy and the army and like moving there and seeing that as the central part of your Jewishness. I mentioned Aliyah here already. The second point in the program is actually Aliyah, and then there's further points that go down. The one that is particularly interesting to me is ensuring the future and the distinctiveness of the Jewish people by furthering Jewish, Hebrew, and Zionist education, fostering spiritual and cultural values, and teaching Hebrew as the national language, which I don't agree with. Like, I don't think that there should be a national language of a Jewish people that is as diverse. Like, why does Hebrew have to be treated as the national language and not one of many Jewish
Yeah,
languages?
there really should be many different Jewish languages. Like, I mean, there doesn't need to be a uniformity, monolithic Jewishness. Like, that's really contrary to the actual reality of Jewish history and life. That's still ongoing. And I actually think it's interesting reading that point because they say Jewish, Hebrew, and Zionist education. They kind of repeat this multiple times where they say viewing Israel as a Jewish, Zionist, democratic, and secure state. Like, they keep using Zionist in the definition of Zionism, which actually just shows how kind of meaningless it almost is. Like it is whatever these people want it to be, which doesn't mean it doesn't have a concrete reality, but like it's what the organized Zionist institutions believe it should be. And like we see this again in another point, which is strengthening Israel as a Jewish, Zionist, and democratic state and shaping it as an exemplary society with a unique moral and spiritual character, whatever that might be, marked by mutual respect for the multifaceted Jewish people, rooted in the vision of the prophets, striving for peace and contributing to the betterment of the world. I think that's the most like fluffy nonsense line there really is, because it's like you're saying this, but also you're actively committing a genocide in Gaza and ethnic cleansing and across all of Palestine. Not sure how you can really say that you're striving for peace and contributing to the betterment of the world when there's also, perhaps I'd say, the most problematic point in this platform that I've actually raised to like people in my Reform synagogue who are voting in the election and supporting the Reform platform, which is organized under ARTSA, American Reform Zionist Association. And they claim to be against the settlements. They claim to want to end expansions at the very least, if not actively reduce settlements in the West Bank. But one of the platform's points is, quote unquote, settling the country as an expression of practical Zionism.
Which is so vague that it could mean like whatever you want, really. You could read into this, like you could make, oh, it's Aliyah, but then Aliyah is already addressed in another point. So if you're talking about within, like behind the green line, Israel 48, you could be speaking of like, oh, Judaizing the Galilee and the Negev, like engaging like in more changing the demographic reality as having less Arabs in there. Or you could mean like, oh, we are going to kick out the Arabs from Masafer Yatta and settle in Judea and Samaria. It just means whatever you want in that regard. And there's nothing against the worst
I
interpretation.
mean, I think what's strange though is when I brought this up to one of the rabbis at my synagogue, they were like, oh, that is problematic because according to them, Israel is already settled. I mean, Israel, often people talk about Zionism and maybe post-Zionism, and we're not going to go into depth on that. But the idea being that the goal of Zionism, which was the establishment of originally a Jewish homeland, but then a Jewish state in historic Palestine, they accomplished that. Like there is, like often people say Israel has a right to exist, but like Israel exists and states don't have rights, people do. So it's like the idea that settling the country is a core part of Zionism, I think just shows how, frankly, liberal Zionism is an oxymoron. Like you can't support settling the country and actively creating and furthering and ultimately like creating a dominant Jewish majority that feels like they can't have rights to calling this a Jewish state without that Jewish minority, forcing Palestinians into the position of being a minority in their own country. Like that's core to the Zionist program. And I think it's really important to call that out. And as we go forward and talk about the different slates, like kind of shows that it's really hard to do anything remotely, anything that really could be called leftist through this institution.
Yeah, I mean, we could stay on this document and like analyze everything in a, I don't know, like a Talmudic way of what this means to this person, this means to this person. But suffice it to say, I think just to summarize this part on it, when if someone were to ask me like, why am I not a Zionist? What am I like? Then there are the sort of this is what I point to. On one hand, this, and on one hand, also the practical existence of the Zionist project in Israel since its establishment. Like these words don't exist. That it's not like 100 years ago that you can say, oh, this was a fantasy, or oh, this is never going to work, or oh, this has bad consequences. We know what this program and how it's been amended has led to. And I think you should accentuate both the terrible consequences that are that like in the name of Zionism are done to the Palestinian people, but you can also hear speak in very clear ways in how a lot of these points are damaging to Jewish communities themselves, in Israel to a certain extent, but also in diaspora. Like, why is the platform saying that there's only one national language of the Jewish people? So when I say I'm not a Zionist, I say it both on the like the practical realities on the ground, how it impacts Palestinians. And also, I don't believe that Aliyah, like leaving to Israel, is a core Jewish value. I don't believe that Israel is the central part of my Jewish identity. I don't believe that Hebrew is the national language of the Jewish people. And I think that that's like a concrete point that you can make. And the alternative to that is like organizing Jewish life in diaspora and not and like saying that to counterposing the centrality, you say that every Jewish community around the world has the same rights to exist and none of them are more or less valid than the other in this way, and that there are many Jewish languages that should be cherished and nurtured, including Hebrew, of course. But not one that is superior over the other. And you should say that Jews should have a right to live where they are and have a right to live in safety and equality wherever they are. And this is a co this would be in opposition to this program. This would be a anti-Zionist vision.
Honestly, like the Jewish community in the US has its own interests, its own things that it needs to be doing in order to make our lives safe and secure. And of course, that's not just for Jews. Like, I think we've made it abundantly clear throughout our conversations, like, Jewish interests are tied up with the interests of all minoritized and oppressed peoples. There is no Jewish interest, Jewish agenda. Like, that is a anti-Semitic idea. But I mean, if you look at the history of like Jewish communities' responses to the rise of Zionism, like many Jewish communities were against Zionism precisely because of the way that they saw it contributing to this idea of like dual loyalty of like, oh, you're not really supportive of your nation, you're supportive of the Jewish nation instead. And that was historically been seen as anti-Semitic, that, oh, Jews have their own interests. Like, yeah, that's problematic, especially when it's being used to essentially say that Jews want to rule the world. Obviously, that's going to be the most problematic way it's being used. But the idea of dual loyalty in itself is problematic. But that's kind of what the Zionist organization's done. I mean, one of the points in this platform is nurturing mutual Jewish responsibility, defending the rights of Jews as individuals and as a nation, and really core, representing the national Zionist interests of the Jewish people. I mean, What is the national Zionist interest of the Jewish people? Do you have any idea? I mean, what is it? The need to have a state, the need to kick Palestinians out of their homes so that Jews have a place to run if there's anti-Semitism elsewhere? Like, I guess that's arguably what they're saying, but it just to me feels extremely problematic to claim that there is a national Zionist interest of the Jewish people as a whole.
Yeah, and of course, like we could go here into further like, oh, there are class differences within the Jewish community and who gets to represent the Jewish community, and so on and so on and so on. There's an election coming up. It's happening right now. What's the situation? You've looked into this a bit more than I have in certainly regarding the American context.
Yeah, I mean, so obviously I'm most familiar with the American context. I like in my synagogue that I work at and have grown up at, there's actually a booth that says vote reform and encourages people to vote in the Zionist election. So there are a total of 500 seats in the Zionist Congress, and 38% of those go to Israeli representatives. This means that essentially, I mean, it literally is the last Knesset election basically maps on to the Zionist election. So when Zach earlier said that the Zionist institution isn't the state of Israel, it's actually, it partially is the state of Israel, but it's the state of Israel plus the Zionist federations around the world.
A small point in that regard, does that go to also non-Zionist parties? Like, does Hadash, like the Arab Communist Party or the Islamist Party, do they get seats? Or do they refuse to join? Food for thought.
I would probably assume that they're striked from it just because they wouldn't agree with the Jerusalem program. Yeah, that's a good question. And in a way, this entire conversation is meant to be food for thought. Like this election's going, we want people to be thinking about, should we be voting in this? I mean, again, do we want to legitimize this? I would say probably not. But like 38% of those seats go to Israeli members of the Knesset. 29% of these seats, about 152 seats out of those 500, go to the American Zionist movement, which is why it's actually like quite significant. And if we look at the 2020 elections, they happen every 5 years. Only 123,000 people voted.
Which is pathetic. I mean, when you think of this as being described as like the parliament of the Jewish people,
Yeah.
what kind of turnout are we looking at
I
here?
mean,
Like 5%?
that's far less. I mean, how many Jews are in the US? I believe it's like 7, 8 million people, depending on who we consider Jews. Like, that is a tiny, tiny percent of Jews, percent of people voting in the United States. And so you have 38% going to Israelis, 29% going to Americans, and then 33% are going to non-US countries around the world.
Some indications, just going to say, some indications do say that the turnout is going to be
Oh,
higher
I'm sure.
this year. I mean, especially given the political situation, but also there's increase in the Hasidic turnout. There already was in 2020, but when those communities vote, they often vote like en masse. Like the rabbi says, the Rebbe says, you know, go vote for this, and then people go and vote for this. So we'll see how like that compares to other communities and lists, but that's already having a significant impact, and of course it's going to have an increasing impact in Israel as well in the coming
I
decades.
mean, I think it's pretty dang clear that the turnout in the US is probably going to be, I wouldn't be surprised if it's literally twice, if not three times as many people voted in 2020, simply because so many more people are engaged with Jewish politics than there were in 2020, which I think is sad that it took. I mean, it's sad because most of those people are probably like hardened Zionists and want to just have their voices heard and feel like they're making an impact and feel involved and connected, which is again, like, I think there's an extremely valid argument to make on tactical voting. I mean, this is something that comes up every 4 years in the United States of like, oh, as a leftist, should you vote in the presidential election? Should you vote, if you are going to vote in the presidential election, should you vote for the Democrat or should you vote for a third party? I will say myself, I've voted third party for the last 2 presidential elections, and unless something significant happens in the Democratic Party, that'll probably continue that way.
Yeah, but you're also in California, so that is made a little bit easier for
Yeah, I
you.
mean, that's the thing. There's a very clear tactical voting dialogue where it's like, oh, if you're in a purple, like a swing state in the United States, many people say, even if you're a leftist, you should probably vote for the Democrat simply because your vote actually does have an impact. When you're in something like California, where even this in 2024, Trump lost by several million votes, it's like tactically, it's actually better to be supporting a third party so that you're able to try to get them up to that 5% threshold. Like there's reasons to really consider how you're going to vote based on your situation. And I think there's a, my brother is actually making this claim, and part of why I wish he was here for this conversation, that like it might be worth voting for the most left-wing slate, which is called the Hatikva slate. It's a coalition of a number of center-left and some that might even be considered more to the left than center-left groups. Hatikva, it's funny to say that, it means our hope. It's also the name of Israel's national anthem. So obviously, it is still a Zionist slate because it's still a Zionist election. And I have a hunch that they actually have to play that up because if I'm actually sure, even with the way that they've played it up, and we can go into the slates going forward because there's in the US, there's like 20 something slates, many of which are very, very far right.
Yeah, some very fun names there as well. I will also mention when it comes to the group supporting the Hatikva slate, you have Hashomer Hatzair, Habonim Dror, J Street, and the Jewish Labor Committee is in there as well, which is fun to see. The Bundist established organization going a little bit away from its roots, but that's how it is sometimes. But yeah, there's I think one of the main points when it comes to tactical voting is that that this election, it's not a student union election. You actually do get influence, especially when it comes to funding stuff. There's been this number of like $5 billion dollars thrown around as a budget that can go that goes into, and also like the work that that happens through the Jewish National Fund and other para-state institutions, you know, the sort of basically de facto state organizations of Israel that are not a state, because then that means that they can work towards like the helping Jews in Israel, but because it's not the government doing them, therefore it's not discrimination towards non-Jews. But you know, you can make a solid argument. It's when it comes to like actually getting down to it, whether or not funding goes towards like helping construct new colonial settlements in the West Bank, or whether they go towards, I don't know, like general Jewish communal funding in America,
Or Poland.
that is a difference. Or Poland, I mean, who would, God forbid. So there is that argument to it. I don't know if actually not voting to actually keep the turnout low would in itself be an argument to not vote, or to basically spoil your ballot. I don't know about the logistics in that regards, but if you voting third party or voting none of the above works as showing the political organizing groups that there are people that are committed enough to go through the actual process but don't like any of the options. And so it is some sort of group that you can pander to. And with these things, you know, a few hundred, few thousand extra votes might make a difference. So that is also a case to be made. But what are some of these fun groups that we want to give a shout out to?
I mean, I said one, maybe two could be considered on the left. And as someone that works in a Reform synagogue, I think it's worth saying that like the Reform movement is explicitly a slate. Like they actually in the 2020 election got the most votes. They had 31,483 votes and had 39 of the what, 152 seats.
So that's the equivalent of like 20 synagogue memberships in Brooklyn or something. Like it's really not that much in terms of actually like
No.
how right what the level of participation is.
Yeah, and behind that was the Orthodox Israel Coalition, which is another slate that exists this year as well. This is the Orthodox Union, many other Orthodox communities, and these are groups that like are synagogue movements first and Zionist organizations second. But then there's other things as well. Like if we want to look from the right.
I will also say, just before, just to interrupt you, I did mention earlier that, you know, Haredi, like strictly Orthodox or Hasidic movements will have a strong base in terms of turning out. That's why, you know, the Hasidic parties and religious parties in Israel have such consistent votes, because people don't like sway to vote in either for them or not. It's just that is what the community votes for. But then, of course, on the other hand, a lot of them won't vote in Zionist elections, right? For ultra-Orthodox Hasidic communities, they won't consider that to be a part of what they do. That's going to be the decision of the various different rabbis and rabbinical dynasties within these movements. But that's an interesting thing to observe. So go ahead. What are some of the our fun far right slates that we want to shout out?
Obviously, we're focused on the U.S., but there's the Zionist Organization of America Coalition, which includes some wonderful groups that we love, like Beitar, the classic far-right revisionist Zionist youth movement. You also have groups like American Friends of Likud, Young Jewish Conservatives, Save the West, Americans Against Anti-Semitism, American Friends of Judea and Samaria. Yeah, there's like 38 different groups that are part of this far-right Zionist of America coalition.
That's just one slate.
Yeah, that's just one slate. And this is the one that's explicitly like a pro-Trump slate. It is arguably the most far right, but it's a tough competition for who's the most far right. You also have Israel 365 Action, which its entire platform is vote against the two-state solution and for Judea and Samaria. You also have, I mean, there's a centrist liberal Zionist slate, the Jewish Future, which I think is maybe the most centrist of it, but it also includes in their slate combating anti-Semitism. We will fight against anti-Semitism in all its forms, on campuses, in media, and in political discourse, ensuring Jews worldwide can live with dignity and security, and making clear that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. And that's the centrist liberals.
It's interesting to see Aish having its own slate. For those of you who don't know, Aish is basically like Chabad that will take you bowling and give you ice cream. Like, they try to be a hipper version of it, so maybe they're counting on like campus organizing there. In terms of like going back to the fun ones, number 23, Herut North America, with just a big picture of Jabotinsky on their main platform. So that's fun.
It's kind of funny to me that Herut has a North America branch that's a slate, when Herut is like the predecessor to the Likud. So it's kind of strange to me that it's just very strange to me looking at the slates, because it really is just a list of right-wing groups. And then, like, maybe one or two that could be considered on the left, as we said, Hatikva and maybe Reform.
Yeah, I guess, I think to some extent, you know, it is funny to see all of these, like, little organizations, but also we should make that clear that, like, in the Polish presidential election now, there are, like, 25 candidates, but, like, 15 of them are right-wing or far-right. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be a majority, although, of course, the far-right is gaining in the opinion polls. But that's also, you know, that just because there's more of these slates doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to be the majority. It's probably that they all have their own, like, drama and hate each other. And I'm sure that if you talk to one of these groups, you could actually get a lot of tea as to why all the other ones suck. And they're the only true Zionist fascist group that deserves your vote.
Yeah.
Oh, number 13 is intentionally left blank. Is that because that's the bad luck one? That's pretty funny.
That's a good question. I got the impression that that was one that may have been dropped out or something. You might be onto something. There's also Merkaz, which is the conservative Masorti Jewish movement, another synagogue movement. I actually think it might be good to like look specifically at the actual platform of both Vote Reform and Hatikva, because again, we're saying that these are the left-wing groups. I mean, arguably. Hatikva, actually, we'll start with Reform. What we believe as the Reform movement, they believe in a strong, secure, democratic, and Jewish Israel, as envisioned in its Declaration of Independence, focusing on Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state and defend its people from terror. Again, kind of just accepting the far-right talking points as normal and valid, validating all that, but maybe pretending to be on the left. Religious equality, of course, that's a big part of the Reform movement, because the Reform movement actually is kind of marginalized in Israel, so they really want to focus on religious pluralism, which is inter-Jewish religious pluralism. They care about regional security through peace and stability for Israel, Palestinians, and neighbors. This is essentially a two-statist position that's largely been the line of the Reform movement for decades, though I actually think it's kind of walked back since October 7th in a real way. Focusing on women, minority, and LGBTQ rights, but of course not explicitly naming Palestinians as part of Israeli society. And that being said, they do their final point is a secure Israel alongside a peaceful Palestinian state is vital for stability. Yeah, any thoughts on that platform, Zach?
I mean, I've had a look at it. It seems like the sort of run-of-the-mill stuff that is going to attract enough people. And if you had to ask me, would I rather have these guys make up a majority or at least a significant plurality as opposed to like the little clown lists that are populating here, then that is what I would prepare. I was actually looking at some of the Orthodox lists as well. I've mentioned them a few times already as it's a factor that's being described. The Eretz HaKodesh list is interesting because you actually see something that you don't see on many of the other ones, which is that that specific candidates are highlighted as either being you're under 35 or a woman, which are requirements per election rules. One of each four delegates has to be the age of 35 or younger, or two out of every five delegates are female. And you can have a young woman under 35 qualifies for both. But that's interesting for some of the Orthodox lists that they have to put up, you know, at least 35% women and the age factor, of course.
And of course, this is like a list system. So does that mean that they have to put them towards the top, or can they just put all of them at the end so that basically none of them are guaranteed to win any seats at all?
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting when you look at the Eretz HaKodesh list that the number of hashtags which do delineate women, there are more of them at the bottom than there are at the top, just
Yeah.
looking at it from abroad. But there has to be at least some at the top. So that's good. That's going to be interesting because as far as I know, there aren't any Hasidic or Haredi members of the Knesset, but because they don't have this
Yeah,
requirement.
and then I want to talk a little bit about the Hatikvah slate as well, because as we are really wanting to encourage our listeners to like kind of decide for yourself whether you'd want to vote for this, because again, I think there's a valid argument to make that strategic voting could have an impact. But do you want to look into a little bit of that? I mean, we can read the who is endorsed and sponsored this list. I mean, it includes the Reconstructionist movement, I think, is one of the groups that Zach didn't say, the National Council for Jewish Women, Teruah, which is a center-left rabbinic call for human rights.
That was a very long sigh from Ben over here.
Yeah, I have my thoughts on Teruah. They should be the center of Jewish politics. Like, they should be considered centrist, but with how far right Jewish politics are, they're considered left. And then New Jewish Narrative, Partners for Progressive Israel, Israel Shelanu, which is a group that literally has a picture of Theodor Herzl as their logo. So obviously, none of these groups are going to be necessarily perfect at all for anyone that is not a pretty proud Zionist. I mean, they say, we are proudly Zionist and proudly progressive, but what does that mean?
Well, it's some of the stuff that you see here is stuff that we could agree on. I mean, there's the call for an immediate negotiated end to the war in Gaza, just being explicitly there, is a nice thing to have. It's interesting to what extent they are going to get support. I think we should watch this, the Hatikva list, in that regard. And yes, you know, there is probably in people that are involved in this, there's a realization that, you know, we have to pander towards like Zionist aesthetics in order to smuggle in some like social justice and, you know, a recognition of a future peace between Israelis and Palestinians, which would be nice.
I do think it's valuable to say, like, the reform movement, part of their pledges are to curb funding for and prevent de facto slash de jure annexation of the West Bank and for or the resettlement of Gaza, which is like, okay, that's like kind of the bare minimum, but I think it's like good that they explicitly say that. And Hatikva says they fiercely oppose the policy of permanent occupation and annexation of the West Bank without a diplomatic pathway ensuring freedom, security, and sovereignty for both Israelis and Palestinians. We will continue to perpetuate the cycle of violence for generations to come. I mean, obviously that's a bit more elaborated, but like this is why we say like there's arguably two, because two that might be considered on the left simply because they're in opposition to the idea of a greater Israel. It's sad that we only have two that might be. Actually, I'm going to look at some of the other lists and see if any of them say anything, but I have my doubts.
Which, you know, liberals and social democrats can do good work and they can do good practical work within the existing institutions. And it's a little bit, you know, I don't know if it's cynical to just sort of be on the sidelines and say, oh, well, I'm not doing anything because these institutions are terrible and I'm not going to do anything to really change that. But then there are people that do get involved and they do good work. Is it changing massively or like changing the status quo? No, but it is an improvement as opposed to, you know, having more nutcases from far-right Zionist slate number 47 gaining wider involvement and support in the Jewish community.
Yeah, I really don't know if any of these say anything about anything. I'm looking at some of them. I don't think that they really say anything. But, I mean, there's a couple that are like two-stateist. No, there's one. There's two that are two-stateist. And that's pretty much it, arguably. You could say Vision is maybe, I'm not reading the full list of it, but they are claiming to believe that Palestinians should at least have dialogue with Jews. They at least use the word Palestinians. Most of the slates don't even use the word Palestinians at all. But even Vision, which I don't know much about at all, I'll be honest, doesn't seem to be supporting a two-state even, which again, two states the bare minimum and arguably not much more likely than a single democratic state for all.
Let's mention some of the stuff happening outside of America, because of course that isn't the only place where things where these elections are taking place. We did mention earlier that in total about 75% of the delegates are elected, but in some places the Jewish communal leadership just appoints...
Not the Jewish communal leadership, it's the Zionist Federation in particular.
Ah, well, there you go. I mean, that's also part of the situation at hand. And frankly, like with many Jewish communal decision-making systems, it's not exactly clear how these things are done. And it's sort of assumed that, oh, if you are a big like activist and you decide to spend time in this and get involved and like often have to like physically go and meet the right people, then you find out how it works. But to an outside observer, there isn't easy information in this regard. So two examples that we have over here are, I know that there are elections happening in Britain just because I've seen some of my friends and mutuals campaign in that regard and try and gain support for the progressive lists, obviously. The thing that's interesting in Britain is that recently there was this big situation where I think it was 36 deputies on the Board of Deputies of British Jews signed a letter, which again didn't say, as you can imagine, anything radical or extremist in regards to ending the war and coming out against the war and not like going hand in hand with supporting the Israeli government. And 36 of them, including a member of the executive of the Board of Deputies, were suspended, as far as I've seen recently, which, one, great democracy you have over there. You know, members of parliament oppose the direction of what the government is doing, so you suspend them. I mean, can you imagine like a parliament doing that? The British Parliament, the American Congress. I mean, maybe we're going down that direction, but still, that is, when we're talking about democracy and Jewish communal institutions, this is a pretty good case in point.
Yeah.
And second of all, this, and I don't know if this connection has been made explicitly in this regard. I saw some articles writing about it, and I don't seem to believe so. But during the time of an election to the World Zionist Congress, like this can very much function as a fear tactic, right? Or suppressing the support, because instead of being able to focus on the election campaign, these people have to now focus on unsuspending themselves from a complete nonsense charge. And we've actually had a little bit of information about what the situation is like in the Netherlands that, Ben, you know more about than I do.
Yeah, I mean, we actually had Meretz Netherlands, if you know anything Meretz about this. Meretz was effectively the most left-wing Zionist party in the Knesset. They don't really exist anymore because left-wing politics are dead in Israel. They merged with the Labour Party to form the Democrats. Kind of funny to me. But Meretz Netherlands actually followed us on Instagram. So I've gotten to look at some of them. And I want to make it clear, like, they're historically, at least we know that there's been elections in Australia and Canada and Mexico. But it's actually very, very challenging to figure out at all which countries are actually holding elections and which are just appointing them based on how they're feeling. And what we were able to find out from the Meretz Netherlands account on Instagram is that they actually, this is the first year they've had in a long time, if not ever that the Netherlands itself is having, it says for the first time in many years, so I'd assume maybe once upon a time they did.
Like, you might actually not know, like, the information has been lost or in archives or whatever. That's also like something you don't know what the election results were 20, 25 years ago. You can't find that information clearly, which again, compared to an actual parliamentary election, is crazy.
Yeah.
But because it's Jewish communal elections, therefore, you know, we don't have to worry about it.
But basically, they're actually holding elections in the Netherlands, and Meretz is trying to get some support. And I think it was actually clarifying to see what, to understand what this process actually looks like in smaller Jewish communities, to kind of look into the Netherlands as a case study, because in order to have the Meretz Netherlands be one of the lists in that country, they had to submit a list of 100 people who support the candidacy for their Zionist Federation in the Netherlands. And they achieved that, and they're running in this election. I mean, there's funny things to say about Meretz. I mean, when I did my Zionist indoctrination program when I was 17 in Israel, we did a mock Knesset, and the Meretz being the most like pro-peace, pro green transition, pro basic ideas of racial and economic justice, like they're not significant at all in Israeli politics. But when we did a mock Knesset election with like 50, actually I don't remember how many kids, it was like 50 to 70 kids from the US and a couple from Canada, guess what party won the most votes amongst that young group of Jews? Which I think just shows how diverse, no, not diverse, how divergent American Jewish, broad, frankly, we can extrapolate beyond that. Like, I don't want to reify a diaspora versus Israel divide because I think it's valid to see and important to see Israel as part of the diaspora. But it does show how different Israeli politics are from the rest of the diaspora because, like, for the most part, Jews care about social justice, even if they might not consider Palestine to be part of what they would want to see as social justice. And it was really shocking to see how different these things are. And I think it's important to appreciate that there are groups like that pushing for a more democratic Zionist institution. Obviously, it's never going to be fully democratic if it's a Zionist institution and not a World Jewish Congress, which historically did and maybe still does exist as an alternative, but has basically been kind of subsumed into Zionism. I think this might be a good point to kind of think about alternatives because when we talk about things like national cultural autonomy and the idea of a non-territorial Jewish self-determination, the idea of a world parliament for Jewish people is actually like a good one if it were actually democratic and were actually about being a world parliament for Jewish people everywhere rather than around one specific homeland.
Yeah, like that's actually something that I like personally as idea. I like the idea of getting in, like getting into the down into the pits with some of these clowns on the other side and saying like, you know, we are Jewish, we are representing a section of the Jewish community and we want to grow and we want to build our influence. When we say, you know, democratize Jewish communal institutions, we do that knowing that we will not be the majority, at least not in the immediate future, but we do that with the conviction that we can build to be the majority. There's no like inherent reason as to why that has to be the like that it has to be either a small minority or a larger minority. Like we can win. That's a big point on it. And starting off with like a global Jewish parliament might be a bit too much to start off with. Partially because, you know, the kind of logistics to get that sort of work off the ground would be in itself a challenge. And also at a global level, it's also quite challenging to focus on these issues of like Deutschheit and Hinnis.
Also, as like Jewish socialists, I think there's a question to raise of like, is elections that happen once every 5 years really the type of democracy that we want to be building? Because ultimately, like, I think there's extremely valid and important critiques to raise about representative democracy and maybe more localized councils that try to deliberate within each other themselves and come to some kind of consensus might actually be more democratic. Though, of course, that is extremely hard to build, especially beyond a local level. But I think what Zach's saying about the challenge of balancing between like a world congress or a world body and a local body is something that we're keenly aware in our Bundist organizing.
Yeah, and just to bounce off of that, I've recently, well, two things. First of all, I've been interested in looking up some old platforms of the Bund after World War II that have been translated into English. And also, I've been engaging, for those of you who don't know, maybe I'll leave a link in the description. Usually when I say I'll leave a link in the description, I forget about it, which is a problem, and I promise to improve on that. But I've been working on a series of essays called Bundism Today that look more into detail on aspects of like practical stuff as opposed to just historical comparisons and slogans, like how do these things fit into our current context. Soon there will be an essay coming out regarding Deutschkeit. I'm going to be looking into more of this stuff in detail. But one of the things that I think is worth reiterating here is a section of the 1955 resolution of the Third World Conference of the Bund. And there was stuff mentioned in the, I think is the first, that is to this effect. And I think I'll be using that when I write my article. But let me just say this, and you know, when it comes to questions of self-determination or national cultural autonomy, then I think that this is something that should be in our mind, because it's not just post-war. It's also, there was the local municipal Jewish communal elections in Poland in the 1920s and 30s, where 10% of the population was eligible to vote. So it was like, in the interest of the government, what was happening in these places, like it was like a kind of municipal election that was that was being followed very closely. Obviously, that's not going to be the case in most countries, especially not in Europe. But in America, you could imagine a scenario where like old New York Jews are going to vote for the New York Jewish communal institution. Like the American government would care about that. So at least the New York State and such. So when it comes to the platform from 1955, pay attention to this. Wherever feasible, Bund organizations should support the efforts to establish central Jewish communal organizations, and then they use the word kahillas to describe these, on a secular and democratic foundation. The Third World Conference of the Bund deplores the fact that many Jewish communal bodies are still dominated by bureaucratic and undemocratic leaders. The conference urges that the democratic base of these bodies be broadened to provide for true democratic representation. And so there's obviously, like, you can see how this perspective in the Bund's organizing in the early 1900s, the 1930s, the 1950s evolved and was looked at. And what we see with this Zionist Congress is that on one hand, some countries do have elections, but we also see how low the turnout is and the range of discussions that are happening when in there. And it's not a Jewish parliament. It's not a Jewish discussion in general. It's a Zionist discussion. And that is what is being emphasized. And so if we do want to say, yes, we support a Jewish parliament, or yes, we support secular, cross-communal, democratically elected Jewish leadership that we want to contest and we want to fight for, then I think that it's worth looking at countries and communities where this is closer to a reality than in other places. It's worth looking at how this exists to a certain extent in Jewish student unions, local and national and such, and struggle in this regard. And I think that that's the sort of perspective that I would wish to take out from this, that no, we're not voting in the Zionist Congress, but we like the idea of discussing Jewish politics and elections and struggling for that. And that's why we are paying attention, and we encourage people to pay attention, if only as much to see what the problems are.
Yeah, and like at the end of the day, this is your decision. We might have our own perspective on not wanting to legitimize this election, but that's not the only perspective. And I think there's a perfectly valid case to tactically vote in order to try to support the left-wing position so that at least they have some voice. Because if you look at the Israeli Knesset, there really isn't an organized left. There's a few people aligned with Chadash that are doing some good work, but for the most part, the Knesset is dominated by the right and the far right. And we arguably, as Jews, could have a voice to try to balance that. And that's something that is worth consideration, even if it is just simply a harm reduction and trying to take money that would go towards settlements and actually use it to like support Jewish communities wherever they are. That seems worthwhile, maybe. But at the end of the day, we do need to be building alternatives. We need to be thinking about what that might look like. We need to go back in the history, as Zach was just saying, with the Kahila like elections in Poland. Like, that was one option that actually came up quite a bit in like the tumult of the post-World War I revolutions. I mean, we saw a similar model of national cultural autonomy raised in the Ukrainian People's Republic that was, of course, later conquered and annexed by the USSR. We might get canceled from leftists for me saying that. But we do see alternatives that were basically foreclosed by the ultimately assimilationist communists that were saying that there's no future for Jewish people because in order to be a nation, you have to have a land, and Jews don't have a land, so they're not a nation, and therefore Jews are a religion, and Jews, I mean, and religion doesn't have a future because religion is just the opium in the, of the masses, and we need socialism in order to not need that opium anymore.
Yeah, and besides, anyone who is Jewish is actually a Zionist separatist slash fascist slash Titoist. Sorry, I came not too long ago on along some files regarding the Slansky trial in Czechoslovakia, which was like a purge of predominantly Jewish high members of the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia, and I think it was like a Titoist Zionist bourgeois conspiracy,
Wow.
if we're going down that way.
Yeah.
But no, the yeah, there's. Pay attention to this stuff because it's very good to have at least a knowledge of what is going on so that you can form an informed critique.
And also, it's good to be able to make an informed argument as to why you might not want to vote for this. I mean, hey, understanding the Jerusalem program and being able to, when people ask you what is Zionism, to be able to simply refer to how Zionists define Zionism and say, that's not me, that doesn't fit with how I understand my Jewish identity, like that is going to be a stronger critique than simply just trying to stumble through. And like, there's a lot of bad faith and misinformation out there. So it's useful to be grounded in your critique. And I think that's something we're very, very committed to in terms of having these conversations and thinking about what it might take to build that alternative, starting, of course, where we are at home, but eventually, hopefully, to build that alternative at an international level. I mean, the World Zionist Congress is one way in which Jews could be understood to have self-determination. But I think as Bundists, as diasporists, we understand that self-determination is not statism. Self-determination is much more democratic, much more, I mean, as a diasporic people, it has to be much more radically inclusive of alternative ways of being because I'm not Israeli. I don't have any Israeli family. Why is 18 out of 22 or whatever, however many slates, why are all of them focused exclusively on Israel? Seems like we need a bigger alternative. Seems like we need a more open perspective on what it means to be engaged in Jewish politics than simply focusing on Israel-Palestine.
For sure. And with that, let's leave it on that, where we've just approached the hour for you in edit in post-edit land. That's probably going to be a little bit shorter. Theory of relativity and all that. Sorry, I've just been getting a lot of like Oppenheimer shorts on YouTube recently. I might actually finally end up watching the whole film just through them. Thank you very much, everyone, for watching. When we release this, this is going to be out probably on like the last day of the elections. So maybe our non-endorsement is actually going to be the crucial factor in deciding the future of the Jewish people. But on the off chance that that isn't the case, do please stay organized and get involved in local organizing as Ben did. And yeah, and if you're interested in what we're doing, we'll be back to you soon with another episode. Take care.
Thank you. track.